Welcome to NHAS City Spotlight. It's our podcast from the New Hampshire Association for Supervision and Curriculum Development. My name is Bill Carosa, Executive Director. A couple of reminders coming up this fall. We'll begin our series we're calling Whole Child, Whole Educator with PJ Composey. On September 20th, PJ has been the Superintendent of the Year in Illinois before. Look for information. It's on our website right now at nhascd.org. Also, I'd like to announce a special five-part online series for teacher onboarding and mentoring. It's going to be held next fall with PLC Associates, our partner. Look again for more information on our homepage, nhascd.org. Also, big welcome today on the podcast to our co-host, my good friend Liz Cannon. She is now the Director of Curriculum and Accountability for SAU 39 and, of course, a member of our executive board. Hi, Liz.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You bet. You've been on here a number of times. Well, our guest today is an old dear friend, Dr. Irv Richardson. If there was a Mount Rushmore of New Hampshire educators, you would certainly find Irv right there. I see him smiling. You like that, Irv? You can use that line anywhere you want. He's likely best known as the coordinator for public education and school support for NEA New Hampshire. He's also on the doctoral program faculty at Southern New Hampshire University. That's where Liz knows him the best. Liz is one of his students there. I remember his work years ago because I'm an old dude. He was one of the leaders with Jim Grant at SDE, Staff Development for Educators. And of course, in many books he wrote with Jim Grant. He was Maine's Teacher of the Year back in the late 80s. He helped write some national teaching standards, the NTASC standards. His bio goes on and on. We could spend really 30 minutes just doing his bio, but that wouldn't be very interesting. I remember him, I guess, most recently when I was a principal working with my colleague Amy Doyle and myself on a teacher mentoring program in Hopkinton years ago. He's also here, I guess, mainly because this year he has won the Eddie from NHASCD for Educational Leadership, and he'll be rewarded with that on June 8th, coming up real soon by the time this podcast airs. Irv, thanks for your time so much. We appreciate you being on the screen for us anyway and on the audio for everybody on the podcast.
Well, thanks to you too. I'm honored to be here.
So let's talk at the beginning. I really don't know a ton about the very beginning. You don't have to give years because that'll give away your age and all that. Not that I really think you care too much. But you were Maine's Teacher of the Year in 1988. Trace your background. What got you into education? And you were a teacher for quite a few years.
Well, I appreciated you sending the questions because it gave me an opportunity to really reflect. And the moment that came up when I was an eighth grader, I was sitting on the bleachers and we were listening to the speeches of people who wanted to run for student council. And there was a young woman, girl there, and she stumbled and just the speech was a disaster. And I remember thinking, I wished I could have worked with her before she did it. I could have helped her do a better job. And that was really the first spark of, I can help other people and be an educator. And then we went on to high school. I went to Yarmouth High School and you had to take a Shakespeare class. And I said, well, you know, Shakespeare, those are plays that they should be heard and seen and not read. So what I'd like to do is go to the Pineland Center, which was a school for disabled youth, and spend my Shakespeare period working with kids with disabilities. So I did that instead of Shakespeare. And then there was a second grade teacher who was out on a pregnancy leave and the sub had to leave early. So another student, high school student, and I went down to cover that second grade at the end of the day. And I just loved working with the kids and wanted to become a teacher. I felt the best path forward to be a good teacher was to get the best education I could have. So when I went to Dartmouth, I was one of like seven or eight people who were in the teacher education program. So studied there and then did my student teaching in first grade in Lebanon and then started teaching fourth grade in Winnesquam Regional School District. And I can say the year, 78. So people who like doing the mental math can figure it out.
It's hard to believe.
It is. Where did that time go?
I don't know.
So how many years were you a classroom teacher and kind of where did you go after that in your career trajectory?
I taught fourth grade in Tilton for 2 years. And then my dad was ill with lung cancer. So I moved back to help my mom and support my dad while he was sick. So I started teaching third grade for a one-year position in Freeport. Times were different then. The principal, who was a woman, hired me and said the last three people in room 13 have gotten pregnant, so I was going to hire a man or a nun, and I figured a nun wasn't a sure bet. So I got the job teaching third grade in a one-year position, and then there was an opening for a grant for gifted and talented. So I taught gifted and talented for several years, and then we had the opportunity, because parents requested it, to start a multi-age program, which is how I met Jim Grant. So we started a program. I designed it with four other teachers who wanted to be a part of it. And we wanted to give kids a voice. So what we did is we started the program by having the kids involved in writing a constitution. The kids were the legislative branch. The teachers were the executive branch, and I, as the teaching principal, was the judicial branch. They could pass any law they wanted about how their school would work. The teachers could veto it. The legislative branch could override that veto, but I made sure that they couldn't come up with a law that contradicted either a town ordinance or a state law regarding education. So every Friday, people would get up and talk about the legislation they had sponsored, why they thought it would help to build a better community. And so I think about those days and being on some of the social studies committees and civics groups here in the state. People, kids should know the three branches of government. It's like, no, these were kids 7 to 11 years old. They can be the three branches of government. And so I still have the bills that they wrote and a copy of the Constitution.
We talk about curriculum all the time and project-based learning. What you're doing is really not simulation. It's real. You're changing the laws, the way things operate in a school. And the more we can do that as teachers, I think the better the experience really is.
And in one of the other programs at the school, there was a woman who was working with the kids on the environment. She had a group called Kids Concerned About the Environment. No, Concerned About Kids Environment. It was CAKE. And they actually got polystyrene banned in Freeport. They wrote a legislative thing to the town council. And then if you go to Freeport now, there is a McDonald's, but there was no polystyrene because of what the third, fourth, and fifth graders, that age kids, did. And two of those people who are now in their 40s are still involved with environmental issues.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, I think sometimes we underestimate what kids are able to do and handle subject-wise, and that's a great example of that.
Yeah,
and someone said to that teacher who was in charge of them, Nadia, that's like, well, I want the kids to feel empowered. And she said, I don't want them to feel empowered. I want them to be empowered.
Right. Again, the difference between simulation and real life. At what point did you decide you wanted to be a school administrator?
Well, when our superintendent left and our principal was asked to go in and fill in for a year while they hired a new superintendent, the principal said, would you like to be the principal? And at the time, I was just enrolled in a program at Southern Maine in public policy. So I switched to administration. And at the time, it was interesting because I was also head of the teachers union. And I said to the teachers union, well, I've got to resign, obviously. And they're like, no, it's a temporary position. So I told them I was going to grieve it so I could be the grievant. I could be the head of the association and the principal at the same meeting, and I would just meet with myself. So
so negotiations must have been pretty easy, I guess.
Yeah,
yeah, great.
Totally agreed with myself for inter-rater reliability. And what I learned was that I enjoyed working with teachers to help them in their classrooms. And they saw me in a different way because I was a colleague on loan for a year. And then it was after that 1 year position that we started the new alternative because the parents requested it and we saw a different way that we thought education could and should be done.
Do you know if any of there's remnants of any of that at the school?
Yes.
There is.
Because it's the Mass Landing School in Freeport, Maine.
Uh-huh.
And the kids actually helped design the school. And there were some wonderful moments, like they wanted tunnels in their school. So connecting the three different areas of the building were, if you were to walk in them, things that looked like subway tunnels. And the art around the building, kids did the artwork. And so they had a big part in designing the school, designing the playground. One of the things which is no longer there, but they also had designed and built a post and beam barn as part of a math unit.
So what about PD? Like, most of us know you really well as active in professional development for educators. When did you kind of get started in that piece of education?
Well, as Bill mentioned, Jim Grant, and I didn't know who Jim was, when we were working in the multi-age program, came to visit my classroom and said, would you be willing to present at conferences? And the used to be a conference in Nashua every year that the Society for Developmental Education, later Staff Development for Educators, put on. So I went down there and presented for them for several years. And then he said, would you be willing to come on as a program director and help design conferences in all 50 states? Which then led me into learning what it is happening in all 50 states and what would make sense. So we expanded. So we were doing conferences for like 2,000 people at a time in big arenas and expos. So it was that opportunity to meet with people and design what would be helpful for you as an educator. It, Bill sent out the questions, which were very helpful. My first PD was, we were in a gym. I had not ever taught a class yet as a formal teacher of record. And we had all the teachers, K-12, all the specialists in one room in the high school gymnasium. And we were learning about the importance of individualization. I couldn't help myself. I'm like, do you see any contradiction between assembling K-12, all these subject areas, talking about the need for individualization? So
I was lucky enough to have you last semester, Irv, as a professor. And in our class, we talked a little bit about, implementation science and some of the things that are proven to best work for professional development. So what are you seeing across the state now, and what kind of things are you trying to drive as far as best practices for professional development?
A couple things. That's a great question. And people talk about data-driven decision-making, and I'm not a fan of that. I would rather have data-informed decision-making. So we need to know for that practice, like, what does the research say? Who am I trying to teach or impact with this research? And then what training, skills, and knowledge do I have that I can help and bring to the table? So that's more about implementation science rather than, oh, there's research that says do this, let's everybody do that. So I think for people's professional practice, they need whatever their area is, if you're a reading teacher or social studies or science teacher. But for the last 3 years, we've written a grant to help people with their resilience. So not only how they see other people, but how they take care of themselves. Because I have this theory that the way that we as educators take care of ourselves and the way we take care of each other and interact with each other is like a computer operating system. That's the system that we have to boot up the programs and experiences that we want to offer to kids. And if I'm exhausted and you and I are not getting along well, that will spill over into what we do for the kids. So we need to make sure that the people who are teaching and administering in schools are resilient educators.
Definitely timely.
I'd like to, probe that a little bit. This is through your work with NEA, I'm guessing,
yes.
Grant. So what have you found? How do we increase resilience in educators? Or is that something that's sort of hardwired into us?
It's not hardwired, because then there would be those people who had it and those people who didn't have it, like blue eyes, brown eyes. No, there are skills and dispositions that you can develop once you know what those are. And I'm not on her staff or paid to sell the book, but we've been using a book by Elena Aguilar called Onward, Cultivating Emotional Resilience in Educators. And so we've provided people with a copy of the book. And Maxine Mosley and I, who work together, she's a retired counselor from Manchester. We readily admit that we're running a Ponzi scheme. So if you benefit from learning about resilience, we will give you books that you can take back to use with your grade level team or your staff. And we had a situation in August of 2021 where a superintendent wanted to kick off the entire year with resilience. And she asked me, well, who should be at this kickoff around resilience? And my response to her was, well, I wouldn't invite anybody who doesn't need to be resilient. And she was like, wait a minute, that's everybody, right? And I'm like, yes. And at the last meeting, we have a meeting of that resilience group tonight. And there have been different groups that have been led where let's study one habit a month. And then let's go out and practice it, get back together as a community of practice. And then how did we do? And what difference did it make? And last month, we had an opportunity to extend the grant for 6 months. So what I said to the people, the 12 people, the 15 people who are there, think about what difference, if any, it's made to you and come prepared to talk about that so I can write this extension to the grant. What I didn't tell them was that the author, Elena Aguilar, was actually going to be joining us to hear what they had to say. So Elena joined us, and this is what someone who was a part of that group, a teacher named Beth, said. The profession is in the direst crisis in our history, and if we don't devote a lot more time and attention to helping teachers live and thrive day to day, it will really be up to the likes of PragerU to teach our children. I had an incredible public education, and I intend to do everything I can to ensure that every child has the same opportunities that I had. If we don't reach out a hand and lift teachers up, there won't be anyone left. Before I started this course, my highest aspiration was survival. I've learned that the obvious and seemingly insurmountable obstacles don't need to preclude my potential to thrive, because the variable I can control is myself.
And we're recording this, ironically, during Teacher Appreciation Week. Are we appreciating our teachers? It seems like, I read an article today in EdWeek, actually, that teacher salaries are the highest they've ever been, even inflation figured in, an average of 70 grand. New Hampshire's slightly lower than that average. Irv, I don't know where to begin on this question exactly, but what are some next steps we should take as a profession? People like you, me, and Liz that are in leadership positions to really grow the appreciation of teachers and, frankly, grow the amount of high school kids who want to be teachers.
Yeah, I think that's crucial. I think the first step is really appreciating yourself as an educator and knowing what your why is and what your mission is, and then respecting others. And you and I will not always agree on everything, but I appreciate what you do for the kids and what you do for your school. So we, as educators, need to start appreciating ourselves and then going out and advocating and showing what an important difference educators make. And you talk about Education Appreciation Week and Teacher Appreciation Week. One of the magic wands that I would like to wave, it's like, it's great that Liz is a teacher and we are appreciating her. If she's a high school teacher, I would encourage her to not only take in the appreciation, but think about some of her students. And like, gee, Bill and Irv, you know, when I watch you in my biology class, I watch the way you interact with your peers and how you help them and explain things. Not that you have to do this as a career choice, but you two would make excellent educators. If you're thinking about doing it, I can put you in touch with the apprenticeship programs and ways that we can help you get a running start or help you lower tuition costs to become a teacher, and really revered in a way that it was not, we've lost that. It seems like in some places in our society, the feeling is that my ignorance is just as good as your knowledge. And that's not the case. We need to hold up education as near and dear.
Yeah, definitely agree with that. So speaking about education and talk a little bit about doctoral studies. And one of the things that I've noticed anecdotally over the years is just the low amount of people with an elementary background in education that tend to be in spaces like doctoral programs or even in administration for that matter. And so that was something that I kind of connected with you right off the bat about. I could, you know, we had that in common. So I was just curious what your thoughts were about that. And what do you think leads to that? What do you think causes that? And how does it impact our teachers?
That's a great question. I think, and I know that you know about the different research paradigms. I think some of it might have to do with that it's traditionally been a profession of women. And I have my great grandmother's teaching certificate from 1859 that says that she's of sufficient moral character to and govern youth and instruct them in the various branches of learning legally required to be taught in the public schools of this state. South Hope, Maine, May 27th, 1859, Frank W. Smith, supervisor. So because it was a woman's profession and elementary was, I think, thought of more as babysitting or taking care of the little ones, not this is a very important foundation. What we set here is really lifelong learning. And not naming the principal, but I did my student teaching, as I mentioned, in a first grade classroom and a follow through classroom. And when I asked the principal, who was a woman, for a recommendation, she wouldn't give me one because men should not be teaching early elementary education.
Wow.
What kind of person was I that wanted to be with young kids? And yeah. When I was honored with the Teacher of the Year and the Milken Award, I almost wanted to say, this is what men teachers do with young kids. But I didn't do that.
Yeah.
Took the high road. There's a lot less traffic and the view's better.
Yeah, I remember you reading us that certificate from your grandmother. I forgot, or great-grandmother, right?
Great-grandmother,
I forgot. Yeah. Yeah, I would agree, definitely. And I think with all we know now scientifically, we know how important those early years are. And it is traditionally kind of thought as babysitting, but there's some really important language and social and developmental skills happening that set the stage for everything that comes afterwards.
Yeah, and one of my fantasies is if we could do the kinds of things that we did in elementary school, and then as kids grew and we were consistent and persistent about those for 13 years, what kind of person could we help grow and turn out from the public education? And schools, yes, but I would also start with prenatal care and helping parents become better educators and not wait until a child turns 5 to start reading to a child or all those things, exploring mathematics.
So. Yeah, definitely. As somebody who comes from early childhood, couldn't agree more. Yeah. Kind of piggybacking on that and thinking about doctoral studies and research, you know, there's a lot more of that kind of being dropped. And I appreciated what you said before, the distinction between evidence-based. And what kind of role do you think that data and research should be playing in teachers' practice now? You know, it's kind of bantered around a lot, but what is the reality of that?
I think the reality is that research is often relegated to write a paper for me, you have to use 3 different sources instead of let me present you with a child who has some issues. You go to the research and find out possible ways that we might be able to help him or her. Mm-hmm. And we wrote a grant through NEA in 2013, and it was helping educators, practicing teachers, get in touch with research. If we were physical doctors, we would have a database. And what is this? These symptoms, how are they presenting? Oh, it's Legionnaire's disease. How do we treat it? As educators, we tend not to do that. We think, well, if you're certified, you're qualified, you don't need additional information unless it's through PD. So from that grant, the actual Department of Education here in New Hampshire has picked up that. So if you are an educator in New Hampshire, you can have access to the EBSCO database. And there are teachers out there who are out proselytizing, trying to get other teachers to use that. And case in point, I was doing a workshop probably about 10 years ago, and woman in Manchester who was a guidance counselor raised her hand and said, well, we have a child who's selectively mute. What could that be helpful? And it's like, you know, I have no idea what the research is, but let's search it. And so we did it there in class. And she said, I think those three articles would be good for me to read. It's like, great, I'll send them to you. I followed up about 2 weeks later. They met on the child, read them, implemented a plan based on that research, and called a year later, and the child had no more issues. Now, was it only because they had done that? There's no way to know that, but it empowered them to say, there might be answers in the research literature. If I go out and search that literature, I can use those ideas to apply to my situation.
Yeah, and I think specifically, you know, I'm in the field of literacy, and you know, there's a lot of curriculum directors and people who are implementing new programs. And so you have people come in from the different programs and tell you kind of what that program does and how it's research-based. But it's really essential for people to be able to look at the research independently without just listening to what that company bringing in that program is saying. And that's really something that I feel like I've learned a lot through the program. And I feel it was important for educators in general. I think it should be included, not even at the doctoral level, but at lower levels, a basic yeah. understanding of how to do that.
I think it should be part of teacher preparation where, mm-hmm. like, how do you access the knowledge base?
Yep.
And I used to say that when people would come in when I was a principal and say, well, what does the research say? And I would say, it doesn't say anything. You have to read it. But then I had a doctoral student who would put in PDFs, and on her way to work, her teaching work, would have the PDF read to her. So now research can talk to you.
And our sophomores in one of the classes I teach, they dig right into EBSCO as sophomores. But you're right. It occurred to me that classroom teachers should have access to EBSCO. All three of us, you know, are affiliated with a college or university, but I don't even know what the cost would be if a school district did that. Do you know of any school districts serve in the state that just say, nope, our teachers should have EBSCO, should have access to research?
Well, they actually, all the teachers in the state, if you're a public school educator, have access to EBSCO.
I don't think I knew that.
I can send you the information and we can put it on the ASCD website, New Hampshire ASCD, if people are interested to explore that further. And then the other thing when talking about research with artificial intelligence, that has totally changed even the class since I had you last fall, Liz, where things like, there's a program called Elicit with an E. I'm not illicit, Elicit. And the problem with AI, with like ChatGTP, is if you put in a topic, it wants to please you, so it'll make stuff up. So you're like, wow, that sounds like a perfect study. It's like it, because it doesn't exist. What Elicit does is you put in a research question. You don't have to use that Boolean logic, this but not that. And then within 10 seconds, it will review 125 million peer-reviewed papers, give you back a one-paragraph synthesis of the top 8 cited papers, and then we'll give you a matrix of things like, what is the theoretical framework? What was the population? So it makes accessing the research much easier than when I was doing my master's in the 80s.
Yeah, it's really crazy. Even that was last semester that we learned about it from the beginning to the end, and it was a huge game changer in my research.
I have to admit, Google Scholar isn't bad either, and that's obviously very accessible. I find it's almost as good as EBSCO at times, depending on the topic.
Well, and it's funny, quickly with Google Scholar, you can put in a topic or a study, and when it's updated or cited, you get a notification of that. And when I was working on the INTAS standards, when I was down in Washington with CCSSO, I put in something, notify me if anything is published on teacher standards, and I still get updates almost on a daily basis. Like, what's that? Oh, teacher standards. Good to know.
Yeah. You know, when I think back on your career, Irv, and certainly when I think of you, I think of just professional development. And we've talked about a lot of areas. I look back to the books you wrote with Jim Grant, the issues we talked a lot about in the 90s, retention, promotion, multi-age, looping, all still important issues now. But I'm curious about sort of the pedagogy of professional development. What are some of the best ways you found to teach teachers in this day and age? As someone who And as a school administrator, was sort of tasked with that. Being in a small district, we didn't have a PD head, you know.
Yeah.
What works these days from what you've seen in terms of really helping teachers learn?
Helping people identify what it is they need to know and be able to do. So sometimes, like the woman, Beth, who was talking about resilience, that's where she needed to be and where she needed to grow. It's not to say that she didn't need to grow in other ways in her profession, but she was exhausted. So by giving her some resilience skills, that was the next step on her pathway that cleared some of the brush and debris and made her walk easier. So I think where people come in with, here's what you need to know, that could be true, but unless you establish that need to learn and do it in a way which is consistent with how people learn, that it can be very frustrating. I had another doctoral student, Crystal, who just was hooded last Friday night, and she was studying RTI, response to intervention, and multi-tiered systems of support. And she realized that the way that they had gone about this was to do like an all-day workshop on RTI, and that was it, which was antithetical to the model of response to intervention and multi-tiered systems of support. So what they could have done, or maybe should have done, was let's use RTI as a model for what we do. So yeah, Bill and Liz get it. Herb needs some additional coaching. That is the RTI model. So let's use the model to help him understand and implement the model.
So I'm curious, Herb, what do you see moving forward as some of the biggest challenges, but also some of the biggest opportunities in public education?
We alluded to it earlier. I am very worried about people not going into education. And then when we do attract people on important pathways like site-based plans, they're starting without some of the preparation that we had. And I think about, okay, if I hired you as an apprentice electrician and said, okay, go wire this house, you'd be like, oh, okay. But if you were working underneath a master electrician and learning those skills, and it was a gradual release of responsibility, then I think that would be more helpful. So I think the opportunity is to rededicate ourselves to what education can and should be in a democratic society. I had the fortunate opportunity to work with John Goodlad and Ted Sizer and studying the education of educators. And one of the things we talked about is, what is the role of education in a democracy? And I think we need to recommit to what we can do as public school educators, but really all education, but how that can benefit and inform citizenry. So I think the opportunity is for us to recommit to polish and refine some of the pathways. If it isn't just going, becoming a student teacher, going through that program, which was a viable model for me, and I think you too, but maybe it's an apprenticeship model. So what's the opportunity for you as an apprentice to help you graduate with less debt and get support along the way with mentoring and coaching? So I think using the knowledgeable, experienced educators, helping them become good mentors, helps to build the social capital, which then in turn we can appreciate each other as educators.
Herb, I say this on so many podcasts, but I really mean it today. I wish we had more time, but I know that we should keep the podcast around 30 minutes. We've gone a little over that. I'd love to do this again. Let's follow up and talk more about the hundreds of issues that personally I, and I think Liz would love to,
yeah,
to
I would
talk
love
to you
to
about.
Do that. I mean, I've been at this half a century, and at least the good part is there's no danger of finishing our life's work early.
No. So thank you, Dr. Herb Richardson. Thanks for your time today. We appreciate not just being on the podcast today, but everything you've done. And you, truly, I joked, but you really are on the Mount Rushmore of New Hampshire educators. And I'm just thankful, and I know Liz feels the same way, that we've had the opportunity to work with you through the years.
Thank you. And it was an honor to get the award and to be on the podcast today.
Yeah. So yes, again, NERV's going to be NHASCD's Eddie Award winner, coming up in just a few weeks as we record this. Look forward to that night, Irv. I hope lots of family are coming.
Yes, I have my sisters coming.
That's great. Wonderful. Liz, you're going to be there. You're going to be able to hang out.
I will be there.
Good. Good. That's right.
Looking forward to it.
Good. Sounds good. Well, thanks again. At NHASCD, our mission is to serve as a catalyst for conversation and action to inspire excellence in teaching, learning, and leading. You could find links to much of what we talked about in the show notes located on our Spotify podcast page, or of course, you're hopefully using an app right now to watch or to listen to this podcast. You can find us on Twitter X, Facebook, and Instagram at NHASCD. You can contact me anytime at bill@nhascd.org. I'm Bill Carosa, Executive Director. We'll see you next time for New Hampshire ASCD Spotlight. Take care, everybody.